everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year!
The podcast has been around for a year. Time flies. I really appreciate everyone's support, everyone who subscribed and have shared kind words. And I look forward to another year. And if you are new to the podcast, welcome. Today, we are chatting to the amazing veterinary technician practice manager. Her resume is amazing. Teresa Cospert Roberts, all about her career, how you can motivate and support your veterinary team, how you can introduce new services into your practice, and more. So enjoy, everyone. Hi, Teresa. I am so stoked to have you here. How are you today?
I am doing wonderful. How are you?
Good. So Teresa has quite a resume and has a really interesting veterinary technician career path. And she's awesome, of course, as a person. So I had to have her on. And to get started, even though I know this is a very broad question, can you tell me a little bit about your career path as far as becoming an RVT, where you are now? And then I know you have a huge passion for education and practice management, which I'm not as hip to practice management. So I'm so stoked to hear about what kind of led you to that passion along with your career path.
So I think it's fairly boring. Other people find it interesting. I have worked in vet med since I was a little girl. When I was a teenager, I was a junior zookeeper at the zoo.
Oh my God, and, I love that.
Oh yeah. I fell in love with it and thought I wanted to go to vet school, and got to where it was a month before we were about to like move me into school, and was like, this new specialty practice in the area has openings. I just want to go work there for a month. And I am so glad I did. I went there and fell in love with being an assistant and everything that I wanted to do. The doctors didn't do that. The technicians did it.
Right.
So at that point, I was like, Dad, I know we're talking about vet school, but I don't want to do that. And from there, I decided to go to tech school. I went to San Juan College, which is a distance program. And did my preceptorship at a local specialty hospital while I was in school. And when I graduated, I worked at that specialty hospital for about a year as one of their head ICU technicians before I was headhunted to work at my current university.
I love that your first job as a technician was at a specialty clinic, and the fact that even as a very young person, because you guys, I was not thinking that ahead at that age, that you were like, you know what, let me try it. And you found your passion. So I think hands-on stuff is so important if you are going to drop 100 G's or more on school.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, having to know what you want to do for the rest of your life at 18 is a whole nother problem. But I love that because I don't hear a lot of stories like that as far as people becoming an RVT.
Oh, yes. So I have been at my current or in my current position for about almost 10 years now. I started out in the small animal ICU, and from there, worked there for about 5 years, ending up being one of the senior technicians there before my current position opened. And I now run the surgery training center at a major school of veterinary medicine. So for all intents and purposes, I am a practice manager. I love it, and I am surprisingly good at it. And I didn't think I would be good at it, but when my husband and I were talking about me making the switch from being clinical to more administrative, he's like, I think you'd be fantastic at it because you are the bossiest person I've ever met in my life.
You can micromanage. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yes. And I am incredibly organized, and I think things through, and I try to be proactive instead of reactive, which makes me a really great manager. And the same things that make me a good manager also make me a good educator. I have a passion for education. I love watching people learn and trying to come up with different ways to help people learn who may not be able to focus on traditional routes. And I think a lot of that comes from me having done distance programs. I wasn't a traditional student. I was older when I decided to go to tech school, and knew that you can see right now, I have ants in my pants. I can't stay still ever. So I'd like to try and find something to do or a different way to teach that fits every student. And I love that light bulb moment where you can see them finally get it. Even if it took 8 different ways of teaching it, when they finally get it, I think it's fantastic. So that's where my heart is in education and practice management and getting all of our technical staff members or just non-DVM staff members in general to where they need to be and making sure that they're fulfilled.
And you have a very large staff. Obviously, at the school, I feel like larger than most practices. So I think that's really interesting. So you worked as an ICU tech, being an amazing badass and doing all this stuff. How did you then start even doing administrative stuff? Was it just like, hey, I have some time? Or you probably started educating staff just as a head tech. I mean, that's a big part of setting staff up for success. But how did you get into that administrative role and then take that role?
I fell into it.
That's how we do in vet med, y'all.
Right. I ended up, I fell in love, got married, did the typical fall in love and get married thing, and popped out a litter. I had my son, and anybody who's ever worked in emergency or ECC in general knows that you can't work in the ICU and have a kid.
Yeah.
And I was in ICU with a kid and trying to breastfeed at the same time too. And it's okay, there's an emergency here. Oh, but I got to go pump. Or there's an emergency here. So it was trying to find something that kept me in the field doing what I love, but also made sure that I had an appropriate work-life balance and I wasn't running myself into the ground and not being there for my son, or my husband.
Right.
So eventually the woman who was in my position before, retired, and of the 100 plus technicians in this building, my name was one of the few names given to my current supervisor as a potential replacement. And from there, it was just a trial by fire because she, without getting myself in trouble in case she hears this, she was very old school and had been doing it for 28 years. So nothing was written down.
Interesting.
And when she retired, she just retired. So I came in and they're like,
whoa,
fix it, Jesus.
Oh my gosh.
And I have pictures of what it was like. And I am privileged to have a boss who is not a micromanager at all. And he said, this is what I need done. I don't care how you do it, as long as you don't do anything unethical. And that if I can make sure that I can defend everything that you do with the dean. And I took a dilapidated space and turned it into an amazing teaching center. And we have numerous classes that go on here. We have NIH level research, all of these amazing things that I'm excited to be a part of. And I did all of it by just trying my hardest and trying to never say no and just trying to say, I don't know how I'm going to do that. Let me figure it out.
Oh, that's amazing. See, I feel like in vet med, we thrive because it's part of what happens. Mm-hmm. Most of us thrive being thrown into things. Like I do better when they're like, your lecture, y'all, I have written lectures the day before. Don't judge me. Mm-hmm. They're still good. People like them. But I feel like a lot of us kind of thrive on that being thrown into the fire. And you had to, I feel like
it's
probably really overwhelming. And you had a child, which just makes, let's be honest, everything a little more challenging in life because you have a kid to take care of and think about. But I'm guessing it might have been a little bit exciting because since everything was a bit of a mess, you could kind of start over, but also that was probably, I can't imagine how challenging that was though.
It was incredibly challenging. And there were days where my boss would walk in the room and I'm on the floor and he's like, oh my God, what happened? I'm like, I just needed a minute.
Mental health break.
But the wonderful thing about being in challenging situations is, as long as it's not a challenge that's going to break you, when you finally succeed and do what you want to do, it's such a rewarding feeling. So it was incredibly stressful to walk in and say, hey, for the past 28 years, everything's been paper. But we want to be paperless now. And class starts in a week.
Oh,
And
man.
oh, yeah. But we are, for the most part, paper light. Everything's on a server. The server's set up. There's a digital calendar. There are all of these different things. And I can look at everything I've done with pride. And every time somebody compliments something or compliments my boss, I'm like, yeah, he didn't do that. I did it.
It takes a team, but
Yeah.
also some strong ass women, as well. So with such a large team, especially because in a school setting, it's a little different. Obviously, we have turnover in practices, but that's a whole nother podcast, y'all. But you're probably having a lot of students come in and out, and then your staff that's always there with a staff that large, how would you recommend, and again, I love these heavy questions, motivating and supporting your team? And I know a big part of that is empowering them through education, which it sounds like you've even created a lot of new education opportunities, not just for your staff, but for other veterinary professionals to come to the school and learn more.
So the way I motivate them or empower them is just by learning what their love language is. So whenever I have a new employee start, in their interview, I ask them, how do you like to receive instruction? How do you like for people to show you that they appreciate you?
I have never
And
been asked
then,
that,
oh,
Teresa.
yes.
You're blowing my mind right now. Sorry.
And then once a year when we sit down for annuals or at Christmas, so sorry to any employee who's listening to this, but next week I'm going to ask you when I hand you your Christmas present, is there anything that I can do differently or anything about you that's changed to help me show you that I appreciate you? And I actually sit there and listen to them. And I think of it like it's almost like a marriage. And I know that whenever you hear somebody say, oh, we're a family at work, that's a red flag. But I look at my relationship with them as if it were a marriage and compare it to my relationship with my husband. Do they like acts of service? Do they want me to show that they appreciate them? Or do they like words of affirmation where I just need to say, hey, employee, I know today was stressful, but you did a really good job and I'm really proud of you. I don't know how the hell you got that catheter in that dog, but you got it in and you're a badass and you're awesome. Do they want that? Or do they like gifts or money? Like I like being told, Teresa, you're wonderful, but my husband's like, give me stuff. Buy me that new
That
modern
is my
warfare.
husband too.
Yes.
My reinforcer is I mean, money's cool, but my husband is like in when I've worked, I work for myself now, so it's a little different. I'm my boss, she's a bitch. Like I remember when I would be either working with an organization or working in GP, and I'm a big words of affirmation person and verbal praise, like genuine, because that's a whole other.
Yes.
It's obvious that you're very genuine because it's interesting because I think you'll go to a CE or you'll read an article, which obviously we should always critically think and apply, but a PM might see that and say, I'm going to say thanks to my staff. Or we always joke in vet med, fucking pizza parties. And to be fair, I love food, but as a vegan, I never even had options, which is bizarre with like small staffs that I would work with. And they just wanted, it was just, again, super, super isolating and very interesting. So I think if you are genuine, if you are listening, which I could just tell by, I could see her body language because you guys can get the video. When you're genuine and care about your staff and you're saying those words of affirmation, but I'll be honest, in many cases when I was getting those, they were generic as fuck. Like it was just like, you do not care. You're just saying this because I've been here for 14 hours and you don't want, I remember crying at work and saying, I can't physically go on before. And that's a bummer. Sorry, guys. And I was literally like ignored and kind of mocked by my PM.
Nope.
And It obviously I'm still a little triggered because it was a really long time ago. So it's just so nice to hear. And I know there's a lot of amazing PMs out there. Woo, woo, woo. We love you. But I think even when I go to CE or read articles about practice management and what we want, what's being said is kind of generic, like as a whole. So when it comes to making those connections with your staff and being genuine, let's say a PM feels like everyone doesn't like them, or because to be fair, I think that happens sometimes too, where a tech is thrown into a PM role and business and PM skills are not their skill set. So to be fair, they're kind of thrown into a position where they necessarily weren't set up for success. So people don't really give them a chance. How would you recommend a tech who's kind of thrown into that position, who's working as a tech and a PM, to best reach out or connect, or even a new PM? Because in VetMed, I don't love it, but sometimes we could be a little mean to people who are new. I'm just being honest. How would you recommend a PM that's new or either recently got the job but work there connect and reach out to the staff and show them they care?
The first thing that you can do, because we've all experienced that new manager that you instantly just hate because they, or that new employee you hate because they immediately come in and tell you everything that we're doing wrong. And I'm sure that y'all have, if you've worked in specialty practice before, you've experienced it with people from a certain vet school. They say, oh, here comes the pinwee, because at such and such school, we did this. At such and such school, we did that. So one of the first things that you can do is just be quiet, close your mouth, sit down and listen. And when I go consult at a practice, especially when there's a new practice manager and they're bringing me in to help train that person, for the first 6 months, we're going to be quiet and we're going to listen and we're going to watch this practice. We're going to sit down with every technician and we're going to go to lunch with them. And then we're going to spend several hours with them, just listening to every frustration that they have, every concern, more importantly, every idea that they have, things they're interested in, things they want to be better at. And before we can institute anything, we need to know our team so we can know how to lead them. And if you can do that, if you can just sit down and be quiet and listen, there's not a team in the world that you can't get to be on board and buy in to what you want. But first, you have to buy into actually being a part of that team. And I think that's where a lot of managers make mistakes. It's just that we immediately jump in and say, you're doing this wrong because of this, 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 and that's old school medicine and blah, 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 without saying, okay, let me see why you're doing this, what your thought process is behind this, and then I can make itty bitty bites at fixing this or finding a different way to show you to be more productive or just practice better medicine.
And I'm sure you haven't experienced this, but I could see this possibly happening. Let's say the PM doesn't have support from the owner, who may be a veterinarian or maybe an owner. I mean, nowadays there's practices that have owners that just are financially involved and have say, but don't even show up or appear at the practice, which I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. It's just, it's interesting. And I could see positives and negatives of that. How would you recommend a PM, for all my PMs out there, get support from their kind of higher ups, business owners, to get the support they need to take those steps to, because sometimes I think they're told, get them to work more, which these very direct things that just, we know your whole, like we know in VetMed, when one person leaves, everyone does. And that's not because we're being catty. It's because their eyes are open and we've all been struggling for quite a long time at this practice. Like, it's not new. It's very obvious. So do you have any tips for our PMs out there who may be struggling to get support from the higher ups to get done what they need to get done?
When you're even considering taking a job at a practice, when you're sitting in your interview, you need to gauge what that owner is like. And the big thing for me is if I go to a practice and do an interview with them, if the owner's not there, I don't want to work for you, because you're hiring me for one of the most important positions in your clinic, because I support everybody else, and you can't even show up for the interview. If I'm going in as a consultant and I'm sitting down with the medical director and the hospital administrator and the owner's not there, red flag. And the first thing that I want to do is say, where's your owner? They're not here. Okay. I'm sorry you spent this money to fly me out. We can finish this when your owner's here and it's important enough for them to care. Because if they don't care enough to buy in and support you with your team, you're not going to be successful at that practice. You're not going to have anybody stay and you're not going to be able to get anybody. So the best advice I can give, and without sounding especially toxic, is the owner has to support you. And if they don't, it's not the right practice for you. And if you are in a practice where the owner doesn't support you, or they're wishy-washy, or they give you instructions without actually backing you up when you need to enforce them, then you need to leave.
I do not think you're wrong. I think sometimes, whether it's you're really into behavior or whatever it may be, and you're not being supported and you laid really clear criteria. I'm a huge fan of laying super clear criteria at the interview. And kind of doing those things. I think that considering I put you on the spot, I think that's a really great practical tip, because now that you think about it, I feel like I have been to interviews where like I'm going to be, you only have one tech on your staff and I'm going to be that tech. So I'm probably going to be overworked automatically. And then you don't even show up to the interview. And looking back now that I'm thinking about it, those weren't good fits. That's my nice way of saying we weren't a good fit. And that's okay too, because hey, PMs, every practice is looking for you. So you got choices, y'all. I know it's not always that simple, but one positive about VetMed, I always tell techs, like, we're a need. You are a need, and we are needed everywhere. So please don't settle, because sometimes, even if you're the best PM ever, if you're being thrown into a situation like Teresa mentioned, where the upper management doesn't support you,
Or doesn't care.
I think that's a big part of it. It's going to be really challenging or almost impossible to make a difference. And you're going to be emotionally and physically affected, legit. So I think that is a wonderful tip. And I know you mentioned that you consult with practices, because Teresa wears many hats, like many of us do, because you know how us techs are. Can you tell me a little bit more about your consulting services and what that kind of looks like?
So I am the senior consultant for National Veterinary Solutions, and it's not a traditional consulting firm. We cater to technicians and advancing all non-DVM staff. I mean, we do work with DVMs just because, like I said, I work at a vet school, so I'm used to being the mama bear with them. But our focus is on technicians and assistants and practice managers, and educating them and consulting to get them to where they need to be. My primary focus is practice management. So one of my big things is talent acquisition and recruiting employees, engaging them and retaining them. So a big thing for me is, it's like everybody wants to get new technicians and, oh, there's a technician shortage. But a huge part of that shortage is keeping qualified technicians. So what can practices do to motivate and support employees? What can we do to help them grow? Because as a manager, my big thing is that my goal is to make it so that any of my employees can leave at any time. They can say, Teresa, such and such hospital offered me something else. And I can say, babe, that's great. That's fantastic. I'm so proud of you. Bye. And I know that sounds stupid, but hear me out. You're like, what the hell is she talking about? I don't want my employees to leave. No, it's, think of it as if it's your child. You want your child to be the absolute best that they can be. You want to give them every single tool that they need to be successful and to be able to grow and be happy and be fulfilled. I want every employee who works for me to be able to take that big job with MedVet. MedVet's hiring for such and such, and you're qualified for it, and they can pay you more or offer you better hours. Baby, you have to take care of yourself first. Go. But I also want to make sure that I am giving you everything that you need so that you're so happy that you don't even look. You don't need to look. I'm giving you everything that you need to be fulfilled. I'm paying for that CE. I'm making sure that you're getting your VTS. I'm making sure that you're doing everything that you're interested in. And if I can do that, I don't have to worry about losing employees. I don't have to worry about, okay, Tabitha said that she's doing she wants to do her VTS in behavior. I'm going to pay for Tabitha to do that. I'm going to set up puppy classes and do all of these things so that she can get training. And I'm going to pay for her VTS. And I'm going to come up with ways to incorporate that into the practice.
I would have stayed at that clinic, just saying.
Absolutely. You're not going to go anywhere because yeah. I paid for you to go to school. I'm giving you what you need to be fulfilled. I'm making sure that you're happy. And if you're happy and fulfilled, you're also generating revenue for the practice. So it's win-win.
100%. And so we've talked a little bit on the podcast about, like, I talked with April Bays about it, and it always comes up because it's interesting, this technician shortage that, with the pandemic, mm-hmm. and all of us techs and assistants and even vets were like, y'all, I don't know if this isn't new. I love that you're writing articles about it now. Mm-hmm. And it isn't because techs aren't going to school. To me, I mean, more and more people want to be techs because of badass technicians out there helping people recognize what a technician is, what we can do. So obviously I think a big part of the technician, again, I don't even, because this technician shortage or
the shortage that's not actually a shortage.
It's not actually a shortage or turnover mm-hmm. is a result of members, not teams, not being supported and not having any of that stuff that you have kind of talked about throughout the podcast. So if you had to give three tips to, if you want to give more, I get it, to our PMs out there, because I know there are quite a few PMs that are veterinary technicians, or to our amazing vets out there who may own a business, about how to keep their qualified technicians, what would you recommend?
The first one, and it's, people don't think this is an issue, but it is. It's just common sense, paying them appropriately, making sure that they have a livable wage. And if that means that you need to raise prices, baby, then you raise prices. Or better utilize your technicians so that your practice is making more money because the doctor is not doing technician skills. So one of the things that I do is that I teach practice management courses. And the first thing that comes out of my mouth when we're talking about staff is that the person who makes $100 an hour shouldn't be doing something that the person who makes $25 an hour can do.
Right.
So we know that veterinarians can diagnose, they can prescribe, they can prognosticate, and they can perform surgery. If it's not one of those four things, a technician can do it, or an assistant can do it, depending on the state. So there's no reason for a doctor to not be doing doctor things and bringing in more money. And if the doctor's doing doctor things and bringing in more money, the technicians are better utilized. They're bringing in more money. That means you can afford to pay your technical staff members more. So it's providing them with a living wage. The second one is offering them opportunities for advancement or career growth, finding out what they're interested in. You can't just look at your technicians like, oh, that's Teresa. She used to work in ICU, and I mean, she's bossy and like, no, Teresa is interested in practice management. And I know that Teresa's interested in practice management. So I'm going to pay for Teresa to take the CVBL course, and I'm going to pay for her to go to VMX or whatever practice management CE is available. And I'm going to pay for her to sit for the practice management exam. And I did all of these things for Teresa. Teresa sees that I'm invested. Now, Teresa's probably not going to go anywhere.
Right.
I mean, she could, but she's probably not going to. So those are just things that we can do to show that we're interested. But most importantly, it's paying them appropriately, making sure that they have all the tools that they need to grow and be successful, but also have opportunities for advancement. And that doesn't mean that you need to take it seems like at most practices, every lead technician ends up being a manager at some point. Yeah. And not everybody's supposed to be a manager. I'm bossy, so it works out really well that I'm a manager and I'm fairly organized. It's okay. I know I'm bossy. I've known it since like the third grade when my teacher put in my report card. Teresa is very bossy.
Oh my gosh.
But not just automatically telling people you've hit your ceiling, you can't advance. It's saying, okay, let's make you a VTS. And Then once you pass this exam, we're going to start behavior classes for you, or we're going to start this, or we're going to have you do this, or we're going to reach out to other practices and see what we can do to build you up. Or if you have an older technician who's doing a fantastic job, but they're having trouble being on the floor more because they're 37 like me, and every time they get on the ground, it sounds like somebody's eating Rice Krispie treats, then let's make them a trainer. If they like to teach, let's have them train. Let's talk to local vet tech schools and see if that person can go out and teach some labs. And in doing that and empowering that technician, I'm also bringing focus on my practice. And if that technician goes to that vet school or tech school and teaches those students, and those students see, hey, this person's at this practice and she's great and she's a good teacher and she's actually going to teach me, I'm getting more employees from that. So it's really simple stuff that can make a big difference.
And I don't think practices realize how much if you have a staff member who is traveling and speaking at conferences or being mm-hmm. highlighted as like these, whatever it may be, how much amazing advertising that, like every time mm-hmm. I do a lecture, the first thing I'm asked is, where do I work?
Yep.
Cause whether it's the general public or, to vet techs. And I, that's been something that's been pretty eye-opening to me, because it's not surprising now, but mm-hmm. at the time, I don't think it's not common in vet med where techs who are doing amazing or other staff members who are doing amazing things are being highlighted by other organizations, whether it be like NAFTA or AVMA or whoever, mm-hmm. or just like your city. And the business owner just completely ignores that.
Yep.
And doesn't do anything with it, or says, you only get 5 days off per year, and you're going to, if you want to speak at that conference, it's going to be your 5 days off, which I have been told. So I love that example, especially of, as that person gets older, because I know so many techs, which thankfully, guys, because our bodies shouldn't hurt. That's a whole nother thing. We're teaching better handling and more, I mean, to be fair, just any handling skills is becoming a thing now. So that's less likely. But there are changes as we age, realistically. And I know so many techs who have been in the field for 20 or 30 years and they didn't want to leave. And cognitively, they were there and they are amazing with their skill set. And they had no other opportunities, so they left vet med. Mm-hmm. And that example you gave just off the top of your head is amazing and genius. And getting staff members to your hospital, but then also having an experienced technician teach other techs. Oh, God, I love that example so much. I think that is, gosh, she's just got all the wisdom. So you guys need to have Teresa at your practice. That's why consultants are great, you guys. We can get around because mm-hmm. we can be in more than one place at once. And that's a great segue into, because I know this is something you're passionate about, and I am too, when it comes to introducing new services into your practice, which in turn really is a way to do a lot of the things you were talking about, like empowering your staff, allowing them to do what they love. And honestly, it's selfish in a beautiful way, because you're empowering that staff member to do what they love.
To go make more money.
Exactly. And we understand that every staff member can't be super educated in everything. That's not realistic. So, hey, this staff member is going to know a bunch, be able to make us tons of money, but then also teach the other staff stuff about that thing. So when it comes to introducing new services into your practice, could you share a few examples of what these services could be and the benefits for, because I think sometimes it can be hard to, I hate to say sell, but we're selling ourselves, y'all. This is just facts. And sometimes I think as a technician or an assistant or even, you know, a CSR, they have all these amazing ideas. They're great at this thing. And they staff, like business owners or the owner won't listen to them. So can you talk a little bit how to introduce new services into your practice from the staff member's perspective, but also the benefits for the business owner?
So whenever there's a technician who's interested in a new service, I get approached a lot with this. With my I have at least an email a week from a technician that I don't know saying, Teresa, this is what I want to do, help me.
Oh.
The first thing that you should do when you're interested in introducing a new service, as a practice manager, I want you to know a considerable amount about what you're talking about. So you need to sit down and you need to do research on that topic before you present it. Depending on how approachable management is, you can talk to them and say, hey, if I wanted to present something to you, how would I do this? Or if you're in a practice where you don't think they're approachable, reach out to a mentor if you have a mentor. If you don't have a mentor, reach out to me because half the time I'm not doing anything anyway. But you need to know the topic inside and out. You need to be able to explain the need for it and really think outside of the box when you're talking about the need for it. A new current thing that's big is explain how it helps the human-animal bond. I want to
Yeah.
know that from my employee. Explain the benefits to the client and the pet. Explain the benefit to the hospital, and more importantly, explain the or justify the cost. And the best example that I can give is something that I recently went through with a friend. I have a friend who's really interested in behavior, and she wants to do her VTS in behavior. And her practice does absolutely nothing in, with behavior. They are not low stress or fear free. They are manhandle them, let's get them done. So when we sat down and talked about how she could introduce this and start possibly puppy socialization classes or behavior visits, the first thing that I told her that we needed to do is do our research. And we know that in shelter medicine, the average age of an animal that's surrendered to a shelter is between 16 weeks to 18 months. Well, why is that the case? It's the case because if you look at that time period, that's the gap between vet visits. So that 16 weeks to a year is the gap between that last puppy shot and their annual visit. It's also the tail end of the first fear period. It's when adolescent behavior issues start to show up, and it is right smack in the middle of that second fear period. It's when Fluffy becomes a jackass sometimes, depending on the dog. For my personal pets, it's when Sebastian suddenly became afraid of the umbrella and the doorbell.
Right.
And it's when most owners, especially if it's a new owner, they're not at a vet. They don't have anybody to talk to. They don't have family members that understand. They're seeing Caesar Milan on, hopefully I don't get sued, Caesar Milan on TV talking about being the alpha male, and they
Yeah.
try to be the alpha male and get nailed in the face.
Right.
And those animals are getting sent to the shelter. So we know that if we come up with a solution that fits in the timeline of that gap, we're helping with the human animal bond because we're keeping those animals in homes. We are making sure that that animal doesn't end up at the shelter and that animal doesn't end up potentially being euthanized, especially if they've bitten somebody. So we've already knocked out three of those questions. The next thing that we need to talk about or be prepared to answer is how much is it going to cost the practice to do what you want?
Right.
So if I want to do puppy socialization, it's going to cost me, it's going to cost the practice space. So depending on how many people, an exam room or an open area in the practice for an hour a week, let's just say that the overhead on that's going to be $100. Or if we do it outside in a grassy area in the backyard, it's not going to cost us anything because that area is not being used anyway. Or if we do it after hours, it's not going to cost anything because we're not taking away revenue. As far as labor, I know I need at least one technician. That's going to be me, the technician that's interested. So we need to figure out what the total compensation is for that technician. So it's just that technician's salary times 1.4, which is roughly the ballpark of total compensation. So if that's an employee who makes $25 an hour, 25 times 1.4, $35 an hour, and I need them for 2 hours a week, the $70 a week. And then we need treats and clickers and target sticks, maybe. But most of those things we can get donated from our reps. Because I'm pretty sure that my, I don't know, random company rep would love to give me sticker clickers that have their name on it.
Oh, for sure.
Cool.
Reps, reach out to
So yeah.
reps. We don't do that enough, and they could afford to bring a speaker. I mean, there's so many things that reps can
Yes.
help with. Yeah.
Especially if their name is on it. If
Yep.
I don't know, Interceptor or whatever company has a clicker that has their name on it, or bags of treats that have their names on it. I'm pretty sure you could get your Science Diet rep or Royal Canin or whomever to donate treats for it, or just ask the owners before they start puppy classes to pay for it. So we're looking at supplies, which could potentially be zero, the cost of space, which could potentially be zero, and the cost of that technician for 2 hours, $70. And we charge, I don't know, I think a puppy class, $50 a puppy class, and we have 15 puppy classes, and we have 10 puppies in that puppy class because we want them to be socialized with other animals as well as people and different things. If we sit down and look at that, if we do 6 groups of puppy classes a year at those numbers that I just gave you, that's over $40,000 in profit for the company. And that's after we've subtracted labor. If after we subtract labor, I think it's like, I'm from New Orleans, so you have to excuse my math, because let's be honest, we're lucky that I can read. I think $36,000.
I can't do math like that in my head. You're pressing me a lot. So
so that $36,000, that's enough money for me to pay for all the CE that she needs, for me to pay for the VTS, for her to go to whatever conference she needs to go to take it. It's enough for me to pay for Karen Pryor Academy if she wants to do that. Hell, that $36,000 is enough for me to pay for CE for every technician on my staff for a year. And every assistant, probably the DVMs too. Or that's also, depending on the state I'm in and how much people make, that's enough money for another staff member.
Yeah.
So that is the short-term benefit for the practice. But even then, remember, we're thinking outside of the box. We're looking at long-term benefit too. I have kept that animal in the home, which means that that animal for the next 10 years is going to be coming in for annual visits. And depending on where you live, an annual visit is anywhere from $200 to $400. Over 10 years, that's $40,000. And remember, I had puppy classes of 10 puppies, 6 times a year. That's 60 animals that are now staying at my practice and having all of these things done. That's what, $250,000 a year for my practice now? And all of those owners have had good experiences. So when those animals eventually do pass, they're probably going to get new puppies and stay at my practice.
And so they're going to refer you. Like,
oh, yeah.
I have a list of referrals from to the clinics, and it gets them a lot more clients because yes. I would love my list to be longer, but it's a process, y'all.
But it's, if you phrase it like that and look at it to where a person who is very much human animal bond, they're drawn in by that. The doctor who's looking at the bottom line, what's this going to cost me? They're drawn in by that. You have completely justified why you should put this in place. You've given them a game plan. You've given them everything that they need to be amenable to starting. And more than likely they're going to start. And if they don't, even with you having done all of that, it's probably not the right practice for you, because they're probably not going to support you once you are a VTS. So yeah. That is a very long-winded way of saying have a game plan. And know your game plan backwards and forwards, and know every challenge that somebody's going to present to why it wouldn't be successful, and have a response.
I think sometimes I could see someone getting really, really stoked and not having possibly the skill set to do that. Like, for example, victory visits are awesome, but that's a more advanced behavior modification. And if that technician doesn't have additional behavior education, it is not appropriate for them to be. So I think we might get, and I love it. I love their excitement. Or for example, a staff member wants to do a hospice program where they support the clients and all this beautiful stuff, because how many animals, unfortunately, are we not seeing for hospice care? Because people don't realize it's a thing. And animals are suffering and humans are suffering. But I had a train of thought and I completely forgot. See, Teresa, I only have a cup of coffee today.
But even then, to go along with what you're saying, as a manager, when I am trying to decide whether or not, or when I'm consulting and trying to decide, hey, this technician wants to introduce this, I'm also looking at the amount of effort that they put in to coming up with their plan. Because if you can't even sit down and write all of that out and focus on that, I know you're not going to pass your academy exam to become a technician specialist, because you're not going to sit down and study. If you can't come up with this plan and do the math and figure out all of these different areas and exactly what you need, I know you're not actually going to put forth the effort to do it and stick with it if I put it into play in my practice. So it benefits both parties.
Lays out clear. And now I remember I was going to say, you get really excited and I totally get it and I love it. But then you might say, I want to have kitten classes or I want to offer nutrition counseling. But then you, that's all. That's what you go to and you go with them with that. And then you might be like, oh, they suck. They don't support me. But also, real talk, guys. We need to really have a plan in place and address their FAQs, essentially. Like when I am presenting something over time, I'm aware of what I usually get asked. So I address it before it even gets asked, which gets more buy-in and show, like you said, shows that I'm serious and I know what I'm doing. So I think all your advice, oh, you're making me want to hear you talk about practice management. What did Teresa do to me? I want to go to practice management CE from Teresa.
And practice management is so boring. And if you can make it fun, more technicians won't leave the field. Instead, they'll just consider practice management.
No, I think the connecting with others is a big part of practice management organization. Like I am not the most organized person, but if you thrive on organization, then oh my gosh, PMing can be amazing. And then lots of other fat like coming up with creative ways to implement new services into your practice. There's a lot of fun things that you're showing me about practice management, which I love. And then also, I just want to pick your mind a little bit about all the awesome education that you provide through workshops. And because I love the traditional lecture, I'm a little bit of a different type of lecturer. I'm like the most high energy person ever. And but I'm also a huge fan of panels, getting different perspective, hands-on labs. What type of creative educational opportunities have you created or had to meet the different needs? Because we all learn differently. Could you just share a few? I'm sure you have tons, but.
I like models because when you're trying to teach a new skill, a lot of people are anxious or nervous to practice them on patients, which is completely understandable. So I like practicing skills on models. And I start with a low fidelity model. Okay, you're going to place an IV catheter. I'm going to take an IV tube wrapped up or put tape it to a paper towel tube and wrap a towel around it, poke that. And then we're going to get the nicer model from, I don't know, surgery reel that bleeds, or and just any models that you have, any other materials that you can provide, things that give people comfort before they move on to patients, or even it's an aspect that people don't like to focus on, but working with cadaveric specimens. So talking to owners post euthanasia, and this is usually a practice manager thing or a DVM thing, and saying, hey, I know Fluffy died. It's not the outcome that we expected, but we would really like to be able to give Fluffy's life more meaning and help Fluffy save other pets. Would you be amenable to one of our technicians practicing this skill with Fluffy? And if you allow that, I will pay for Fluffy's cremation. And just doing little simple things like that that help get technicians opportunities to practice their skills and opportunities for advancement. So I know that doesn't really answer the question, but
Oh no, I think
those are kind of the
that's
things I look at.
and models I think are really important because just like with handling, I start with stuffed animals to start because a lot of it is technique, whether we're placing a catheter, drawing blood, whatever it may be. I know many of us, like I work with a lot of shelters who have been thrown into situations where draw blood, do this, and they've literally never even been shown how to hold a syringe. And these poor staff members are like, I'm talking about handling. And then as I've worked with more shelters, I'm like, oh, I need to start having
These are the
models.
parts
And
of a syringe. These are the
yeah,
parts of
because I didn't know any of that before I was a tech. And for us to just throw people, and I'm sure this happens to assistants sometimes too, where you're, and I think there's a specific way to handle the syringe. All of these skills should be mastered before we're like, here's a relaxed, low FAS dog, or here's an animal that's really, really fearful. Go. We're just setting up everyone to fail. So ooh, I'm going to have to ask you about some of these models that bleed, though.
They are fantastic. I actually work with an amazing.
I've never worked with one of those.
She makes them herself, and they're incredible. And they even have little paws. And it's just every time she makes one, I'm just in awe. And I'm like, you should sell these. You should sell these.
Oh, tell her, dude. Tell her to reach out. I would love to have her on the podcast and selfishly get some of those. I think that's amazing. So thank you so much for all the amazing information. And since you're really selling this awesome PM stuff, if there are any staff members or technicians that are interested in learning more about practice management or even becoming a practice manager, what are some of your favorite resources or first steps for them to kind of go down that path?
I always tell them to reach out to practice managers in their area and get a mentor. And when you're getting a mentor, you need two different mentors. You need a mentor that you get along with that thinks like you, but you also need to find somebody who's outside of your comfort zone. So
that is such good advice because, oh my gosh, you're like a wisdom pan. Oh, that is because it's so easy. And then you might not. Because criticism, there's a reason for it. There's a right way to do it. But sometimes, I mean, it's really important for us to have that. So that is, that's awesome advice.
Find someone who's not just going to tell you what you want to hear.
Right.
And there are tons of practice management groups on social media. Join the practice management groups. And for the first month or two, just sit there and don't say anything. Watch the interactions, watch the conversations, watch what works and watch what doesn't. And from watching what works and watch what doesn't, figure out what kind of manager you want to be, but more importantly, figure out what kind of manager you do not want to be. Because there's always that one person in the group where you're like, such and such is talking about this. I bet if I go in the careers group, they're going to have a job ad up in a couple weeks saying they need new technicians. And sure enough, there we go. So
love it. And then to end the podcast, I always ask, what is something that makes you happy? This could be these awesome models, because that's what's making me happy right now. I'm so stoked to learn about them. That is vet med related or not. So what's something that is currently making you smile?
I have two answers for you. I have the plain generic answer and an existential answer.
Ooh.
The plain generic answer is spending time with my husband and child and doing things as a family. We do art classes together. We go hiking. Tomorrow, my 5-year-old and I are going to a kids cooking class because he has shown an interest in cooking.
I love that.
So yes. Just spending time with the things and people who are important to me. The existential answer of what makes me happy is knowing that I am enough and just practicing self-care and taking care of myself. Over the past 4 years, I've had some health scares, and 4 years ago, I actually had a brain tumor removed.
Whoa.
And it was a pretty difficult time in my life. Yeah. But from that time, I've become typical person after like neoplasia or some sort of health crisis where they're just like, life is short and I'm going to live every day to the fullest and I'm going to focus on what's important to me and I don't care about anything else. And I have to be enough for myself and I have to recognize that what I have is okay and that I am enough and that I don't need to base my life on others' achievements, which is really hard because I'm friends with all of these big wigs in the field and man, Tab just got her VTS and Steven just did this book and Amanda did this and Amanda did that. And here I am trying to wipe 5-year-old vomit off my clothes. And it took talking to a friend from tech school who also she did her VTS and I was saying how amazing she was. And she said, you think I'm amazing? Girlfriend, you have your own company and you do this and you do that and you go home and you have a husband and a kid and all of these things. And I'm so envious of that. And it's just knowing that what you have or what you are is enough and not comparing yourself to other people. That's what makes me happy. So
I love that answer because I feel you about that, knowing all the people, and I think it helps to motivate me in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's not a healthy way. Yeah. So what I've been doing is like recognizing like, okay, I'm feeling a certain way about this, and then being aware of it. And then usually it's because I'm tired as fuck. Like there's secondary and being aware like, oh, I feel like imposter syndrome, like I'm horrible because I've slept like shit the last 5 nights. Like this isn't about, so just that whole being aware thing. And I mean, I love that affirmation of like, I'm enough. I give myself pep talks all the time. You guys don't get to hear them, but I do it constantly, whether I'm working out, whether I'm running, when I work towards the VTS, holy fuck, were there so many pep talks. That's a great answer, but thank you so much for being here. I hope you have a amazing holiday, and I'm sure I'll have you back to talk about all the things.
I look forward to it.
So many awesome words of wisdom from Teresa. Thank you guys so much for listening. And like Teresa said, remember, you are enough, you badass people out there.